The opinions expressed in the following program are those of the producer and not necessarily those of WKTV Community Media.
We hear things in the deep, dark night. We see things in the shadows, in the corners of our eyes. In mind and dim light, we sense things when they just aren't right. Our dealings are not with human flesh and bone, but rather with an essence that defies even the basic laws of nature, like space and time. These elusive selves challenge our logical minds, forcing us to take faith in the unseen, the unsubstantiated. We claim the theory, statistical inevitability, in the imminent manifestation of mystery. Brought to you by WKTV, I'm one of your ghost hosts, Wayne Preston Curtis Thomas. Welcome to a very special episode of Grand Rapids Ghost Hunters Paranormal Podcast. As always, we ask that you please keep an open mind about things that you might not easily believe as we explore the mysterious. Well, we kind of got sidetracked there for a while. I did a lot of aliens, abductees, experiencers, mm-hmm. contactees. But we're ghost hunters, Brandon and I.
Yep.
Co-host.
Try getting into studying other stuff too. But
yeah. Brandon Jose.
Yep. Brandon Jose of Jose History Productions YouTube channel. My last name is spelled Hozee.
But this is going to be a ghost hunting show. Like I said, I got sidetracked. I'm a member of MUFON. Brandon's out Bigfoot hunting. We got sidetracked a little bit. But tonight, we have Mythbusters. They're authors. They're a dynamic duo. They're pioneers of the paranormal. Local living legends right here. Historians, researchers, producers, seekers of the truth. The Duchesnes. The Reverend Robert Duchesne and Nicole Bray Duchesne. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
You guys, your reputation precedes you.
Oh.
Yeah, Brandon and I knew you before we ever met you through your books and your tours. Now that you do tours that match the names of your books.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. The Ghost of Grand Rapids tours and the Haunted History at Kalamazoo tours.
So, the first book I bought, though, of yours was Michigan's Haunted Nightlife, this one. Right. And the Reverend Robert said, no.
It's a good book, but it's not our best work.
It's not the best one. This was the publisher's idea, and they gave us a whopping 3 months to write it.
Oh.
So it was a really fast project. I wasn't able to get into as much research as I really love to do for a book. So this one was a bit rushed. So I would say out of all the books, that's probably the lowest on our list.
A good portion of that book was written while I was sitting at a table managing a restaurant. So.
Okay. Well, this is the first one that I bought. But then, like I say, you said, no, you're going to have to get some of the other ones. So then I went and bought this one. And this is the Grand Rapids, Ghost of Grand Rapids. And, of course, we live here in Grand Rapids. I do, anyway. And so this one hit home. But then, actually, now I just recently bought Paranormal Lansing. This is the one I just bought, but this is the first book you wrote, is that right?
This was the first book, and interestingly enough, we did not pick Lansing for the first book. The very first book was supposed to be Kalamazoo. And when I pitched the idea, the publishers are like, that sounds great, that sounds amazing, but we would really love a story about the state capitol. I agreed, even though I had never been to the state capitol, not even for the fifth grade field trips, like all the other kids get to do in school. We never got to go to the capitol. So I knew zero about Lansing.
I didn't know there were so many haunted halls.
MSU, yes.
Honestly, I think that worked out best for the Lansing book is the fact that there was a guy that was on my ghost hunting team, W Paranormal, that was from Lansing. So he gave us a lot of the stories and where to start doing our research at.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then I don't have one of the books, and that's the Kalamazoo. What's the title of that one?
Haunted History of Kalamazoo.
Also the what you call your tour.
Yes.
And your tour for Grand Rapids is
Ghost of Grand Rapids.
So, yeah, you can check out those tours. I mean, you can give the kind of like the dates or how that works out early on in the show, and then we'll cover that again later on when we do that. Because how does the tour work?
Basically, for any of our tours, you're just going to go to ParanormalMichigan.com. You're going to select at the top the tours, and we'll have those two tours and then any other tours that we add on. I know we've been talking about trying to do like a spooky South Haven or a few cemetery tours that we're going to make available for people to be able to do that, that they might be able to do on their own even.
That would be cool.
Yes.
Now, Brandon's been to the Kalamazoo tour.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's probably you guys are first starting your tour, sounds like.
And then you invited me and Kim, one of our co-hosts, to go to the Grand Rapids one.
Right.
And I was walking with a cane at the time.
I remember that, yeah.
But I didn't have any problem keeping up.
Well, I walk, when I do my part of the tour, I walk with a cane most of it. So no one should really have too much of a hard time catching up when one of the tour guides is walking with a cane.
Yeah, and then you guys are out there in period clothing.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Which is kind of cool.
Yes, yes. Sometimes, wow, that can get really hot.
Yeah.
I'll tell you in the summertime, but
Reverend Rob's walking around in a uniform.
Yep.
Yeah, I've only had heat issues one time with that, and that was honestly because I forgot the canteen, and I was so worried about breaking character that I refused to drink out of like a plastic jug. So, I should have put myself in the hospital, but instead just made myself rather sick for a day or two.
Oh wow. Now, you guys both grew up in haunted houses.
Yep.
You have to start there, I guess, in telling your story. I mean, I want to hear about your influences, too, but you have to start at the haunted, growing up in the haunted houses.
Oh, yeah. I grew up in Ionia, Michigan. We moved into a house when I was 7 years old. I hated the house immediately.
Oh, wow.
We were not, I say we as myself and my three brothers, we had no input on what new house. That was all mom and dad's doing. And so the first day we moved in was the first day we saw the house, and I immediately hated it. I didn't like the feelings I was getting from the house, and turned into a kid who became terrified of the dark because of that house. Slept with the lights on until I was like 16 years old. But yeah, that house. Come to find out later on, when I was in my early 20s, that the former homeowner had committed suicide in the backyard over by the garage.
Okay.
And he was the apparition that I saw in that house. And unfortunately, my bedroom seemed to be one of the hotbeds of activity. Lucky me.
Yeah.
But after a while, my parents even said they started noticing things. We didn't talk about it when I was a kid. They waited till we were adults because they said they didn't want to scare us kids. But it wasn't until then that I even was aware that my parents were experiencing things as well.
So many of the people that come on this show had early influences like that. Brandon did, I did. Reverend Robert.
Yeah, I grew up in a house as well. It was in Portage. We had probably the coolest house in the neighborhood. We were poor, but my father worked as a repair guy for Coca-Cola, and he liked to barter. So he had bartered. We got a pool table. So we had a pool table in the basement. We had a pool in the backyard. We had two fountain outlets in the basement, so you could just go up and get your pop like you do at the restaurants.
Oh, yeah.
So we had the cool house, but I was terrified of my basement. I absolutely was convinced anytime I was going into the basement that there was a good chance that Native American ghosts were going to kill me. I, at that time, called them Indian ghosts. And I kept telling my mom, "Mom, there's Indians in the basement. There's Indians in the basement." And the first thing my mom did was make me quit watching Scooby-Doo because she thought it was making me imagine that there were ghosts in the basement.
Oh, yeah.
And then I had a poster of a Sioux Warrior up on a bulletin board in my bedroom. My mom made me take that down because seeing the Sioux Warrior must have been causing all the problems. And long story short, ended up meeting with the vice chief of the Pokagon Indian tribe related to something that happened in Boy Scouts. And after I was meeting with him, he just insisted that I had a question I needed to ask him. And I had no idea how he knew, but I had just really wanted to talk to him about the fact that he looked just like the ghost that I'd seen in my basement. And I finally, he kind of pried it out of me. And I'm like, yeah, I used to see Indian ghosts in my basement, and they looked a lot like you. And when we had our discussion about it, he informed me that the entire neighborhood I grew up in had been the site of a massacre after the War of 1812 as retribution for the natives helping out the British. So I had seen native spirits growing up in my house, wandering throughout my basement in an area where there had actually been a massacre. And on top of that, he said that my house was relatively close to their spiritual center. So made it real likely that I was running into these spirits. So honestly, when we wrote our first book and I think my mom got the first one off the press, or maybe your mom, one of our parents did. But the one I gave to my mom, I wrote on it and said, "See, Mom, I told you the house was haunted."
Wow.
And in our Kalamazoo book, we actually talk about the haunting that I had experienced as a child. And my mom always got a kick out of that. I'm like, "I told you the place was haunted."
I know you talk about the mounds in at least one of the books. I'm not sure if
it's got to be in Kalamazoo, I would imagine.
And we had the burial mounds here in Grand Rapids. Mm-hmm. And then what they did is the early settlers bulldozed them over, used them for roads to make roads out of them. So do you think that maybe there's some retribution there on the Native Americans?
On some of those mounds there could be. I know the mound that we mentioned in the Kalamazoo book is reported to be a burial mound, and it's pretty much been proven that it's not.
Oh.
But anytime that you have an area where they disturbed a grave just to make travel, I would definitely say you're going to run into the possibility that you're going to have activity there. And I know that they've had to move a few burial grounds for highways and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they just take them right out and put the highway right on through. We had a case where we thought maybe we were having some kind of a Native American spirit come through, because it happened at one house and then just blocks away, the exact same description, and it wasn't normal description that you get for a ghost, and it was right there.
It's around like the S curve area, and like supposedly they had taken burial mounds.
Yeah, they did.
To put the S curve through, so like all the activity was around there, but the activity didn't really match human activity. It seemed much more like it was elemental, because it was more almost like they were describing more like troll type of creature, almost like a gremlin type of thing
that followed them wherever they went.
Oh, see, now that's interesting.
We did see something similar to a gremlin in Kalamazoo.
I
remember we were living in Kalamazoo in a house on Sprinkle Road. It was when her and I first got together, and we had a white shepherd. His name was Baby, and that dog was not afraid of anything. It was the smartest dog I've ever met, and it went out into the backyard, and I remember she came running back with her tail between her legs, and the other dog wouldn't go outside, but he was a lazy dog anyways, but he wouldn't go out. And when we looked out, I looked out and I could have sworn I saw something small running, and I asked her and she told me that she saw a gnome
in the backyard. And this is
I thought it was a leprechaun. She called it a gnome.
But this was in the same neighborhood. This house is the house he grew up in, so we're still talking
about a half
the
mile
spiritual
from the
site.
Same house. House,
maybe some kind of shapeshifter.
It could be, yeah. That was the first time I'd seen anything like that.
It's the only time I've ever seen that, and it was in that yard, and the dog was scared of it, and it definitely got my attention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Native Americans, they have some scary myths.
Yeah, with shapeshifting and, oh, yeah.
The Alaskan Kushtika, the different things, the flesh eaters, they have the scariest. I don't know if that's just...
People closest to the land have the scariest monsters. That might be scary.
Oh,
right there.
Yeah. Okay. you talked about in your book, you said you proposed a question, is Grand Rapids cursed?
I believe that'd be your area.
Yes, yes, because there are one, the S-curve is mm-hmm. the perfect example of that. Another one was the old Ashton building. They actually nicknamed that the most cursed building in Grand Rapids in the early 1900s because it literally had an elevator that would kill people. Most of them were decapitated by this elevator, and it would just run on its own. And we're not talking an electrical hydraulic elevator like we have today. We're talking about, you know, you had to think of Titanic. That's what I say on the tour. Think of the elevators that you saw in the Titanic movie. This is what we're talking about, where you have to close the door. You have to do the controls yourself. And this elevator just loved going up and down on its own, and some people were decapitated by this. And then there was a big fire, and the city of Grand Rapids is like, no, we don't want this building here anymore, and they've never allowed anything to be built there again.
Okay.
And one of the theories is that it was Indian land, and it was cursed. Because, you know, keep in mind, back then, the banks of the Grand River was so much more, was so wider than it is now. In fact, if you look into Grand Rapids, the bank usually stopped right about where the McKay building is now. So anything McKay towards the Grand River was all underwater at that point. So that would put the Ashton building like two blocks away from the banks of the Grand River, the original banks of the Grand River. And a lot of people theorize that Indians were there and they've cursed that land.
Okay. You talk about the tunnels in Grand Rapids, how all these different haunted buildings are connected to tunnels.
Yes, a lot of them are. The old Morton House Hotel, going over to the old Pantland, two of the most haunted buildings in all of Grand Rapids. And then St. Cecilia, when we investigated that, there's a tunnel that
ends in the middle of the road now.
It ends in the middle of the road because they put a manhole going down there, but it goes right across the street to the church. And the church has the same tunnel that stops at the same manhole. There's tunnels throughout Grand Rapids. And what's really interesting is that most of the places that are hooked to these tunnels seem to be haunted.
I've been down some of those tunnels. Yeah, we were at St. Cecilia. I'm going to go over this list of the things I ran into your book that I figure Brandon has been to, or I have been to, or both of us have been to. The McDonald's on 68th Street. Reverend Rob worked there. I've been there. And I asked him if they are haunted, but I took your book in there. They didn't seem to think so at the time, but 36th Street Lounge was Lenny's.
Mm-hmm.
I talked about the mounds, the Ada Witch and Hell's Bridge, the Michigan Bell Building, the Heritage Hills, McFadden's, and Ritz Coney. Mm-hmm. The first case I ever was on was the Mina Decker story. This is one I set up. And you guys talk about that. You're the only ones that I've heard talk about that besides us being there.
Mm-hmm.
St. Cecilia, the Pantland Hotel, USS Silversides. You were Silversides?
Yeah, in Muskegon, yeah.
Yep.
I haven't investigated, but I've been there.
Allegan County Jail, Allegan Grill House and Rock Bottom Bar. You remember that when we went there?
I didn't go there, but I know we were trying to get in it to investigate, but we weren't able to.
You weren't with that group that we went in there?
No, I wasn't able to go with you.
Then
that's
supposed to be the reputation of a lumberjack. And
yep.
There's a certain drink that he would drink. I tried that. It didn't help. But they didn't really want to let us in there.
No, we've had the exact same experience with trying to get in.
Well, the problem with a lot of the things in this area, too, is that there's certain teams that have went through and spoiled a lot of it because there's a couple of not real reputable teams in the Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids area, and some of them have went in and hidden cameras. or they've done streaming without permission and charged money for it with cameras they hid when they went into buildings. So a lot of these places, like even with A1 Printing, a lot of that is just with other teams going in and causing problems that no one wants to deal with letting investigations happen anymore.
I can see that. Yep. Yeah. The Elks Lodge, which was former John Robinson Hospital, mm-hmm. State Theater in Kalamazoo, the Radisson in Kalamazoo, Western Michigan University, I went there, all the different places there. Where's Waldo? They're entombing people on the premises. The State Theater in Kalamazoo, and then Henderson Castle. You've been to Henderson Castle?
I went there like once, because it was like after your tour. I think there was like a deal where we could get a ticket to go there. But I didn't
realize,
it was a jump out scare haunted house. So I didn't really go through it because that's not my thing. I thought it was like another like haunted tour thing. But
tour the first year we offered them, because that was the year that we partnered with Henderson Castle so that they could get a discounted haunted house, their haunted attraction that they were doing with, was with the Renaissance Fair group that was running that actually.
Yeah.
How about your influences and your inspirations? I imagine you've influenced each other. And then at some point, like I say, I knew you as Bray,
mm-hmm.
and you're on Bray. It's a couple of these books. Then all of a sudden, now you're Duchesne. So
right.
This is like paranormal love.
Yeah, we actually met at a joint investigation. It was with Ghostly Talk.
Ironically, when we left, I was telling the guy that I went there with, I was like, that woman, Nicole, is the biggest bee that I have ever met.
And it's funny, like, you said the same thing about Rob. Oh,
I was like, she thinks that she knows absolutely everything about ghosts, and she's not that good. She doesn't know that much.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, and on the way home, we were saying the same thing. I was saying the same thing about Rob. I'm like, oh my God, that guy, Rob, he acted like he knew everything. You know, and then we got to talking after that. We stayed in touch because I had somebody on my team who did not have that great of a reputation, and I didn't realize it yet. And then Rob had heard a few things about this person. And so he reached out to me to kind of give me a heads up, hey, this guy's on your team, he's been known to do this, known to do that, which what Rob proved was completely true, and I got rid of him off the team. But that's what got us talking after the joint investigation, which was an Octagon house over in Washington, Michigan. And and then it just went from there. And then we got married.
Wow.
Yeah.
The Octagon house, I think you talked about that in your book.
I think that's a different Octagon.
That's a different Octagon. Yeah, there's more than one historic Octagon house here in Michigan, but that one was in on the other side of the state in Washington.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Yep. Couldn't stand each other at first.
Now, and then I found out, like I say, reading this new book here, well, new to me, Paranormal Lansing, that your father was on your team at one time. I did not know that.
Yeah, and what's funny George. Is when my dad started going out, my dad, George, when my dad started going out, I was actually embarrassed by it. You know, I almost felt like a teenager again getting chaperoned.
Oh, yeah.
Which did happen, because when I was growing up in Ionia, all the high school dances took place at the National Guard Armory drill floor. Well, my dad was commander of the National Guard Armory in Ionia, so guess who got to chaperone all the high school dances? So at first, it kind of brought me back to those days where, you know, you look over and it's like, oh my God, my dad is watching me, you know? But he proved so valuable and so fearless. I mean, my dad, ex-military, showed no fear whatsoever. You know, when some of us would be like, you know what, maybe this area, we're getting a really strong bad feeling, you know, let's not go in by ourselves, let's at least do the buddy buddy system through this area. My dad's like, nope, see you later, I'm gonna go sleep over there. Oh my God,
he's a Vietnam vet.
He is a Vietnam vet.
Okay.
Yep. Wasn't fearless until one, and that was the only, that was not just the first time I've ever seen him become unsettled. That was the only time.
Can a church be evil?
Can a church be evil? Yes. We were in Bath, Michigan, investigating several different places. We went to where Andrew Kehoe, who was, of course, the murderer, we went to where his old farm was. We did the Bath School site. And then we went to the two cemeteries that have the most victims. And one of them is Wilsey Cemetery. Well, so we get to Wilsey Cemetery and we notice this abandoned church across the street. And I don't know if you guys have ever had this happen where you just, we got out of the car and we're looking at this church and we're just stunned. It's like we can't move. We're like, oh, we could just feel this ominous feeling about this church. And it's funny because Wilsey Cemetery was completely forgotten at that point. It was like, what's up with this church? And my dad, my fearless dad, goes right up to the steps. He goes, I'm going to open the door. He goes right up to the steps. He gets halfway up, and I'm right behind him. He gets halfway up, and he just stops. And at first, I didn't think of anything. Then I start snapping some pictures, and he turns around, and he goes, nope. And he walks back down, and I'm like, you know, I just stared at him for a second, and I went with him because it was so unusual for him to act that way. And everyone else is going around the grounds taking pictures of this church, all commenting the same thing. All of us have just this feeling almost of evil. I think that was the first time I really got close to what evil would feel like. Go to my dad, I'm like, what's going on? And he goes, got halfway up, he goes, all of a sudden I got hit with this ice cold feeling and my chest started tightening, and I couldn't do it. I was afraid to take another step. I could not do this. And he wouldn't go near that building ever again, ever. We went back another time. He absolutely refused to even come along. He didn't even want to be on the street, you know, even sitting in a car, because I'm like, you can just sit in a car. Nope. That was the only place that ever bothered him. And when the publisher asked me to do a book on Lansing, I'm like, I've got to do a book on that. I've got to do a chapter on that church.
Yeah.
I have to. And I've never felt that feeling again about any other location. And it was an old Methodist church. I mean, nothing happened at this church to warrant this feeling. It was just a small community farm church that eventually went bankrupt. Now someone's house.
Yeah.
Somebody.
I like that you come back to these places. I think you did mm-hmm. that at Bray Road too. Seemed like you came back. Once wasn't enough.
A lot of places, yeah, I've returned to just to see if the same thing would happen again, or, you know, to give a little bit more validation to it. And that was one of the places that we're like, we have to go back. And we went back. Some of us went back.
Yeah.
And it was still the same feeling. The exact same feeling. You instantly, it's not, oh, I think I'm being watched. It was, I am being stalked.
Yeah. I've seen Brandon get uncomfortable feelings, like at the Allegan Museum, the jail museum.
Yeah.
He had, I think it was something from oppressed, some kind of a force that was in there.
Yeah, it was very down, like the basement cells. Like, I did not feel comfortable down in there. And like, I had something happen there. And then as I was coming out, I kind of felt like a heart attack sensation. Like, I knew I wasn't having a heart attack, but I could feel that type of energy.
My like, dad, that's close to what my dad said.
Yeah.
With the ice cold, just suddenly getting hit with ice cold.
Yeah.
And then the chest tightening.
Mm-hmm.
He said his very first thought was, oh my God, am I having a heart attack?
Yeah, he's feeling this.
Yeah.
Because he already had, at one point in his life, had a heart attack. So he's like, oh my God, am I having a heart attack? And he said the second he started walking away, the further away he got, the better he felt. And that's when he realized this was not a heart attack, which
yeah.
is probably exactly
yeah.
what happened with you.
Yeah.
Now, I know high EMFs can cause problems, even the hallucinations.
Correct.
But you guys weren't measuring high EMFs
We
there.
Were not.
Yeah.
We were
See,
not.
At the jail, Every time the heat went on at the Allegan County Jail Museum, my detector would go off.
No matter where I was
in the building, wherever, as soon as that heat came on. And then you talked about it in your book, if you have old wiring.
Yeah, pretty much breaks that fear cage. It makes you have the paranoia. It can cause hallucinations, audio and visual. So you'd start thinking that you're seeing something. So if the jail's got that going on every time the heat comes on, I would imagine that on top of the fact that I know several people have had experiences there, you're also going to be imagining things that aren't even happening.
So, yeah, good point.
So you're going to have your normal activity along with the possibility that the EMF could be causing hallucinations to make it even worse.
And some people are more susceptible to those high EMFs.
Oh, yes.
Children.
Yes.
Are.
Children are.
So that's why it's good to measure for that. And you said you used a meter that I hadn't used before for measuring EMFs. I can't remember what you called it.
Like a millimeter?
It was probably for one of those books, it would have either been we were still using the ELF meter, extremely low magnetic field reader, or a tri-field meter.
Tri-field. That's what you said. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you ever seen one of those, tri-field meter?
Like I might have once. I've never used it myself, though.
I used like a couple different kinds.
Joint investigation. I think I might have seen somebody use it.
It used to be the standard EMF before Ghost Hunters made the K2 popular.
The K2 and the millimeter and right.
The problem I have with the K2 is that it's so susceptible to outside interference, and the K2 picks up so many different things from your cell phone.
Oh.
So my problem is that the K2 is honestly a little too sensitive, and it picks up things that it probably shouldn't. So that's why I have stuck more with like the tri-field or just a low frequency tester, because the K2 I honestly think is just a little too sensitive.
K2.
I agree on that one though. Yeah. Because like you get so it picks up like anything. I think it's really good for doing like a baseline sweep.
Right. But it gives too many false positives.
You can get an idea like, okay, there's a lot of stuff here. But yeah, like, because you have like, okay, the fridge turns on, sets it off. Or like, you know, just depending on what the different electronics go off, all of a sudden we'll start going off.
Right. I noticed with my phone, if you have a K2 and your phone, when it just goes through and it starts cycling, trying to find a Wi-Fi signal, that makes the meter go off.
Yeah.
All kinds of different things get picked up by that meter that aren't picked up by other ones. So if you're looking for a source of background magnetic for like an electrical leak or something, it's probably great. But I think honestly for ghost hunting, it's a little too sensitive and gives you too many false positives, which for some people that's great because they just want those false positives.
Oh yeah. K2, every time we used the walkie talkie, that K2 would go off and it'd get me every time.
Yep.
I think there was something there.
She had a member of her team that, with the non-contact laser thermometers, certain radios, when you key them, it makes it give this high spike. And she was her co-founder. Every time somebody would key a radio and she would get this spike, she would get so excited. Yeah, and I'd be like, and I'd tell her, I'd be like, look, we can create this. We can recreate it. It's an equipment issue. And she would get so mad about it.
But. Yep. Yeah. So remember the basic rule, if you can recreate it, it's not paranormal.
Yeah, and I've tried to recreate some stuff at home, right? I have an EMF meter that red light, and then an alarm goes off. But you can turn the alarm off, which I didn't really want to scare ghosts, so try to keep that alarm turned down. I wanted to ask you guys about equipment anyway, and when we kind of hit on this, but so what's the right amount of equipment? What's the kind of things you should take basically, or is there things that are working, things that you can just leave home that don't work?
I think I have a different approach than most investigators. I honestly like to be more of an intuitive investigator. I like to have my recorder, my EMF detector, and I do have a portable FLIR that cooks into my camera, into my phone. But that's pretty much what I stick with. I like to be a minimalist. There's some people out there that bring in like $20,000 worth of equipment for every investigation. So I think it probably more of a personal preference, but most of the people I know that have been in the field for quite a while have a lot of expensive equipment that doesn't get used.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm kind of the same way. Like, I started off like, oh, I got to have all this. And I'm like, this stuff's annoying. It's just in my way. Like, I just want my recorder and my camera. And that's really all I really need.
I think for me, it's my recorder and then variations on cameras.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Like, I carry the FLIR. I rely on the FLIR a lot with the infrared. And then we just did the Xbox hack not too long ago for the camera, but that's SLS camera.
The SLS system, yeah.
So I've been using the SLS a little bit. I'm not exactly sure if I like that or not.
SLS gives you dot, dot, dot.
The stick figures.
But the problem is it gives you... It's trying to read anything. It's trying to find anything that has a human type of shape.
Right.
So you get
so many false readings. It is only designed to find human shapes. It is to track your movement. So anytime anything slightly looks like a human shape, it's going to assume that it found a human shape. Yeah. And then it guesses where the other limbs are. Like if you're sitting at a table and you put your arms out like this, you're going to see on that SLS camera, since you don't have any legs, it's just going to randomly pick your legs, and they're going to be kicking left and right and all kinds of different ways when in reality you're not moving. So that's the problem with the SLS camera, is that it's a hack on a device that is only made to track human movement. So it automatically assumes everything is human movement. It has that false, it pretty much has that false premise that there will be something there, so therefore it has to find it.
Yeah. The FLIR, though, I kind of like the idea of that. And you put it on your phone.
Yeah.
It must cost you a few $100.
I think it's about $280 is what I think it costs for the one that plugs into the Android. It wasn't too bad. It was under $300.
And so then that gives you...
Yeah, that's about the only affordable one. If you try getting a separate FLIR camera, those usually are much, much more expensive.
Oh, yes. I was kind of amazed at how sensitive the FLIR was when we first got it, because I'd seen them on TV, but I'd never actually used one. And... it was right after the pandemic, and we were staying in a hotel, because basically we got locked into a hotel for what, like 3 or 4 months, was it? She was the general, or one of the managers, and we had to stay in there when they were closed for the pandemic. So that was fun. But
they
needed
somebody to stay security wise to make sure
that
nobody
like
broke in.
With the FLIR, if you walk and turn around, you can see your footsteps. So it was like, I thought that was really kind of creepy at first.
We've kind of seen that.
Well, we had one case that was... it was in a house, and nobody had been in. Nobody was living in this house at the time. But we were able to go in there between they had people living in there. So nobody had been in there. We went upstairs, and we had like the FLIR camera going, and we could just see these two blue footprints just sitting like in the middle of the floor. So I went and walked up there, and like you could see the indent. So it looked like somebody was standing there, though there's nobody actually there. But you can see like the outline of the shoe prints. Man, like if you had a piece of furniture, unless somebody was staying there for a very, very long time and then had left, but supposedly there had been nobody else in the building that day, because the person had showed up, like unlocked the door for us so we could go in. So there wasn't anybody in the house, like, because he said, like, I wasn't in there, just, you know.
So you could see the indentations and the discoloration.
And on the FLIR camera, you could see they were blue on the floor, yeah.
There's some good confirmation for you, something's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So
that's a good one.
Everybody out there, the FLIR is like thermal imager.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a pretty good piece of equipment there.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
That's the one piece that I've been real happy with.
Yeah.
The SLS, it's fun to play with, but I'm not exactly convinced that it's giving me real evidence. But I can't really question much of anything you see with the FLIR. I mean, you're looking at infrared, it's there.
Yeah, I think we're kind of old school at this table.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's some phone apps out there that they're compelling. They can put some stuff out there that they've driven me nuts.
Ghost Radar.
Oh.
Well, I'm actually working on becoming an app developer. And I remember back when Ghost Radar first came out, I put it into a software that lets you stop and look at what it's actually doing. And the most popular Ghost Radar out there is a random number generator and a dictionary. It doesn't access a single outside sensor. It does absolutely nothing, but it has a random number generator, and when it hits a certain number, it gives a word. So
it's more like an ovulus app.
Mm-hmm.
They're claiming that it's using all the sensors, and it says that it uses 5 or 6 sensors. It doesn't access them whatsoever. It really was running absolutely nothing but a random number generator and hitting a database.
I remember one of our team members used to use like an ovulus app. And it would just say bacon, like, all the time. Bacon. Bacon.
Everywhere.
Maybe I was a ghost.
Like ghosts must really want bacon.
When I'm a ghost, I will be saying bacon.
Yeah, that's what we figured, too.
Yeah.
That could be true. Yeah. But, yeah, everywhere we went was bacon.
Yeah.
I work in a restaurant, and the last 2 days I've just been going off about how great our bacon is. So maybe that ghost had some really good bacon
See?
Too.
Yeah, bacon. That's going to be a memory that we're going to remember.
I mean, that is one thing I would really miss when I pass, because I do love bacon.
Right. I've found, for some reason, questions like when doing EVP about food seem to have better reactions. Yeah. Like we had a question that we ask on almost every investigation, and it's, what kind of ice cream do you like? And it's, or do you want ice cream? I think it was, we were doing a bed and breakfast, and one of our members came and asked us, basically asking the investigators, do you want ice cream? The bed and breakfast place was giving us some ice cream for, you know, a refreshment at night. And if I remember right, there was like some obscure ice cream, like Butter Ripple or something like that, came out like, yes, Butter Ripple. And we're like, what?
None of us said that. Where'd that come
and
from?
We didn't know what Butter Ripple was. And we looked it up, and it was like an old kind of ice cream. So we're sitting there thinking, that's kind of coincidental that I think you go past coincidence at that point where you get an EVP that's asking for a specific kind of ice cream when somebody walked in and like, do you want ice cream? And it goes like, Butter Ripple.
Heck yeah. That's a perfect question.
Yeah. And actually, we have gotten responses in more than one places by just randomly saying, hey, do you want ice cream?
I try to ask like simple questions that normal people would be able to answer, because I'm not like a lot of people out there who want to find EVP everywhere. I have used EVP as my main means of investigation, but I want them to be actual EVP. I'm not looking for something I think might have been a sound.
Yeah.
So a lot of times I'll ask questions. Like I did have one, I don't know if I still have the audio from it, but I always ask the question, what is 1 + 1? Like one plus one, and one time I had the response, 4. And I'm like, sitting there going, now, is this an actual answer? I mean, you did answer me with a number, but you got your math wrong.
You're bad at math.
So,
being a smart aleck.
and that was the other thing. I was sitting there going, if someone asked me such a super, simple question, I might be like, what's 1 + 1? 4.
Yeah.
I would ask, what's your favorite cuss word? Because I want something that's odd coming out of there.
We did have a cuss word one time come through, and it was about ice cream.
Oh, I like the ice cream question, though.
Yes.
We also had one where we're doing EVP. It was out in just outside Gettysburg. It's a town called Hunterstown. It's where General Custer encountered his first resistance in Gettysburg. And Custer was shot off of his horse. He was pretty much, it was a terrible battle for him. We caught a few EVP that we liked, and one of them was Custer didn't know. And then there was one that we caught, and we were presenting it to the 3rd Michigan Reenactment Group for Civil War out in Grand Rapids. Well, we're in Grand Rapids, here in Grand Rapids. And we were getting ready to present that, and there was one, and we thought it said they didn't know who we was, Custer. We kept thinking that that was what was said. Kurt and I both agreed. It was like it was this voice, and he had an accent. It was like, they didn't know who he was. And then it was like, Custer. That's what we thought it said. But a couple of the ladies thought that what it was is another voice saying, cuss it, which used to be a way to swear back then. So she's like, I think you caught somebody swearing. So even with EVP, you're not necessarily sure what you got, but they didn't know who he was seemed to be pretty dead on.
So did you use a rating system for your EVPs?
You mean based on how clear they are?
ABC?
Yeah. And that one, they would probably be, I mean, if you're going to try to go for the grade, I'd go A-. It was clear, but it was so low in the audio. We had a recorder we stuck in the wall of a building that we did not realize was the old train depot at the time. But we just stuck it in the wall of this abandoned building and let it run for like 8 hours. And then I sat at my computer listening to the audio, trying to find out if anything was on it. And finally, as I'm looking at the spectral analysis on one of the softwares, I start seeing that there's some sound in there in the background. So I isolated the background, and that's what it's. I had to remove the sound of the crickets in the background. And then in that sound is where we had all those discussions. And it was like probably a 2 or 3 minute section in there where there was some sort of intelligence for like 2 or 3 minutes, and the rest of it was just car noises. And it was all the stuff was related to the Civil War. There was nothing there to trigger it. There was nobody there talking. The stuff came in at like 3 o'clock in the morning. And I think we had one that said, stacked outside in a jumbled pile, and we found out that they had stacked the bodies up on that same porch right there.
Where we put the recorder.
We found out later on that they had stacked some bodies there so they could be picked up by the train. And then we had, Cannon sat over by the flag. Cannon sat over down by the flag, and we're like, okay. And then it was, they didn't know who he was. Kester, or might have been Cusset, but we nothing in those 8 hours except for those, like, 2 or 3 minutes of random audio that we captured.
Okay. Now, I think of, you know, the wars and that, and that's usually residual haunting.
Majority of it, yeah.
I think so. And then you talk about different kind of hauntings. I mean, when we would go on an investigation, you'd almost have to give them a lesson in ghosts, what ghosts really are. And you talk about in the end of this book, different kinds of hauntings, intelligent and residual. Can we go over those a little bit? And you have like 4 or 5. You have intelligent, residual, portal hauntings, and then conjured hauntings. And then you also have poltergeist.
That sounds like a complete list, yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know if that was 5 then.
Yeah.
So let's go right from the top. Intelligent haunting.
Well, your intelligent haunting is probably the one that most people are familiar with. It's going to be the ghost that interacts with you. It's aware of the fact that you're there. It may or may not be aware of the fact that it's a ghost, but it is aware of the fact that you're there and might interact with you. Those are the type of ones that may be a little bit more of a nuisance. They're aware that they're there. They interact a little bit more.
Interact. I think that's the key word. Yep. But Casper, the friendly ghost.
Yeah, if you see, and then you have your residual haunting. And I think in the book, I use the same thing I say in our tours. I say residual haunting is essentially, if you're old enough to remember a VHS tape, residual haunting is essentially the same as a VHS tape. It starts out, and a lot of what happens with the residual haunting is the same as what happens in a VHS tape. The first few times you see it, it's really clear. And the more times that you watch it, it becomes less and less clear. Oh. And that same thing seems to happen in residual hauntings. And you'll notice as the residual haunting gets to be older and older, people start saying that they'll see like the knees up and then the waist up. And then eventually they stop seeing it. And there's actually a gentleman that we interviewed back when we were doing W Paranormal Talk Radio. And he was doing a doctorate in theoretical physics. And he would go in with large magnets into haunted buildings, let those magnets go, and he said that like 90% of the time the haunting stopped. So the same concept as erasing a videotape with large magnets, he was trying to do that in buildings.
I never heard of that.
And he said that he was having about a 90% success rate working with one of the, I think it was Northern Michigan University, whichever one did the Pauline, figured out the Pauline lights. I think it was Northern Michigan University.
Was that Michael Lynch?
It might have been Michael Lynch that was talking to us about it. But yeah, so you have those, and then your conjured hauntings. We do talk about an experiment that was done in, I believe, in the 1970s in Toronto. It was a group of extremely intelligent people that decided that they wanted to find out if you could conjure a ghost, whether it had been real or not. And they came up with a gentleman named Philip, who was supposed to have been an aristocrat. He had known the king. I can't remember the exact complete backstory on it, but they all sat together and they tried to have seances to meet this character that they made up. And during the time that they were doing it, they started having him respond by, they'd ask, if you're here, could you knock on the table? And he started knocking, eventually started interacting with things, moving objects. They said that he would like touch people and have all these different physical interactions. And Philip himself had never existed, so it would have been pretty much their psychic energy creating Philip, and he answered all the questions the same way that they had written the bio. So they essentially created the ghost of Philip as part of their research.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Talpa or Egregore, where you create it yourself with your own spiritual energy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's where you get your conjured ones, and then I think with poltergeist haunting are probably...
Well, portal you said maybe was... portals, Ouija board.
Ouija boards, you can tend to or open up the portals. I think that the house I grew up in Kalamazoo, I honestly think we had a portal in the basement. I think that's
Native
why
Americans were coming.
I think that's why I saw so many spirits, is that it was a portal and the Native Americans were going, using that as a portal. So that would be an area where you would have a concentration of more spirits, because it's possibly a doorway between the two worlds. And then the one that we come across, I think most times in cases, are poltergeist hauntings. And there's two theories that we mention in the book. I am now, 11 years after we wrote the book, I'm kind of leaning towards one of the two theories more than the other. But the two theories were the PK energy, which would be that essentially...
Psychokinesis.
Used
to be TK.
Yeah.
Just telekinesis.
Telekinesis. I tend to think that it's more PK, because most of the time when we have a case that has poltergeist activity, it is tied around an adolescent girl who has had sexual trauma of some sort. And there was a researcher all the way back in the 1930s who had found a correlation between sexual history of violence and poltergeist activity. And with the fact that the cases that we've had where there's been poltergeist, it's almost always been a situation where the parents were obsessed with ghosts. The children have had some sort of a trauma, and the children, whenever the children are around, is when they're having their poltergeist activity. And I mean, when you think of poltergeist activity, I always tell people, and I say it all the time on our tour, I say, don't think of the movie Poltergeist, because had that been a real case, it would have been more of a demonic case than anything else.
Right.
But poltergeist activity, there's a lecturer whose name I cannot think of. He's a brilliant man. He does weird lectures.
John Tenney.
John Tenney. Okay, yeah, he's a brilliant man. He was talking in one of his lectures about, he gave this description of what we thought was supposed to be him encountering a demon. I think he said in his lecture, he's like, I walked into a house and the table flipped over. I was getting scratched. Things were getting thrown left and right. But you really can't hold it against three-year-olds. They don't know any better. And he was saying, and he said that his theory was that poltergeist activity, a lot of that was the only thing that the ghosts know how to do. He's like, you've been in a room. He's like, imagine you've been in a room for 100 years. Finally, somebody walks in and they seem to be able to notice you for the first time in 70 years. And you notice that the only time they notice you is if you slap them. He's like, this ghost slapping you isn't being mean. It's just trying to get your attention the only way it knows how. So his theory is that most poltergeist activity is like spirits doing the few things that they can do. I find that most of them seem to be probably PK. But I honestly don't think you need to be afraid of them.
Yeah. Or what you say is not just PK, but it's recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis.
Mm-hmm.
RSPK. But now my grandfather, when he had poltergeist activity, it was dishes rattling, windows, doors, all that typical poltergeist, German word, noisy ghost, mischievous spirit. There was no teenager involved. There was a dead person out in his field,
right,
who was manifesting all this activity in his house. That was actual poltergeist activity. Now, I can understand PK and the power of the mind.
I think of the one you're speaking of, that'd be more of the same concept of what John Tenney was talking about. It's what the guy knows how to do to communicate. He's dead in the field, and he knows how to rattle the dishes. So,
yeah,
make yourself known.
Yeah, so I think there's both. I mean, mm-hmm. What you describe in here, the test that they did, that can happen. And I think that people have to be mindful of that when they're out investigating, that could be a reason. We've come up with different reasons. That disease that football players get from getting too many concussions. We were at a private place where this kid had 13 concussions or something. And so, you know, there was things happening that he didn't know about that were happening to him. But it wasn't paranormal at all. But, yeah, there's a lot of different real-world explanations out there. And I think the mind, the power of the mind, is one of them that you guys bring up in the book rather well, I think. We probably should move on to the final thought. And then that is a haunted house. if you know a house is haunted, would you buy it? And then if you do buy it, would you sell that house without disclosing that you had paranormal activity? I like to start with Brandon, keep him off guard.
Would I sell the house, or are you talking about buying
it? Would you buy a haunted house? And then if you bought it, would you sell it without... Would you feel obligated to disclose that you had
paranormal activity? If I sold it, I would feel obligated to disclose it. I know not everybody's going to believe in it, but some people do. So I would want them to know, you know, whether I would let them know if it's either good or bad activity going on in the, you know, in the house. But because most of the time it's really not negative energy if it is haunted. And like, as far as buying it, it would depend on, I'd want to know like what has gone on in the house beforehand. Is it something like, is it a negative energy? Because if it's not a negative energy, I'm totally cool with the house being haunted.
It's interesting because we investigated.
That would probably make me more likely to want to buy it.
We investigated a house that Brandon owned.
It was one I had been renting or whatever, but yeah.
So you didn't feel obligated to disclose to anybody that we had been in there?
I did not on that one, but that one... That particular one, we were able to more to come to that it was somebody that passed away that we knew and was like needed help crossing over. So like that was more of a personal thing, because like after I was able to help them, then I don't think there was really any activity in the house by the time I got turned over.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. Now with me, Rob, I'll let Rob take on the Park Street house in Kalamazoo. Now what was interesting with that question with me is the house I grew up in. Of course, my parents sold it. I have no clue. I was like 15, I think, when they sold it. I have no clue if they said anything. But years later, after I started the West Michigan Ghost Hunter Society, the current owner of the house, her name was Eileen, got a hold of me. And she said she read about me in a book, and it was not one of our books. It was it Ghost Stories of Michigan or something by Dan Asfar. He's a Canadian author. But he had got a hold of me, and he interviewed me about my childhood home. And so she contacted me, and she goes, I'm wondering if I'm living in your childhood home. She said, because some of the stuff that you're talking about that happened in the book is happening in my family. And she said, in some of the areas that you talk about seeing an apparition, we have seen an apparition in the exact same spot. And then my email back to her is, well, you wouldn't happen to live at this address. And of course, she called me immediately. She goes, oh my God, how'd you know that? And I'm like, no. You're living in my childhood home.
Wow.
So we were invited to go back and investigate again, which was really interesting to be able to do. And, ironically, that was my dad's last investigation. Was going back there. Now, Eileen has since sold the house, but what's interesting is what she did is she left a little scrapbook for the current owners. And she said she left it like right on the counter in the kitchen to where they were sure to find it. It's just a little book, and it tells about the history of the house, you know, what she came up with, what I found out through research. It gave little highlights, what I went through as a kid. She put in her own highlights and then left my contact information, said, just wanted to let you know, this is what happens in the house. Don't be afraid, but if you do...
How nice of you.
Give her a phone call to talk to me. I have yet to hear from the new owners. But what I found that was so interesting is Eileen and her family experienced the exact same things that I was going through. When I was a kid, her kids were seeing the same things. You know, the same activity was going on in the house with things being moved in the same rooms. Yeah, she decided to tell the owners, but in a totally different way, and let them decide later on.
Oh, yeah. That was nice. The Terrace Inn you guys went to, they had a logbook, you said.
They did. Yeah, and they still do. It's even bigger now.
Yeah, we went to the Mitten here in Grand Rapids. They had a logbook before we got there, and we made one up for Nick Finks. I thought they deserved one. when all their activity and as many times as I was there.
Oh my
they
God,
needed
yeah.
the history of it.
Yes.
Rob, you going to buy a haunted house?
We actually did have a haunted house. We were asked to investigate a house in Kalamazoo. It was the Hopkins House on Park Street. The woman that was selling the house was worried about the fact that it was haunted. A group out of Grand Rapids had told her that it was full of demons, and for a small fee of like $1,000, they would get rid of the demon for her. So she wanted to find out for sure if there was really a demon in the house. So our website mentions that we do work with demonic and negative cases. So had us come in and investigate the house. Absolutely nothing negative All about right. it. Definitely haunted. Nothing negative about it. It was for sale. We made an offer for the house. She turned us down. About a year later, still hadn't sold the place and decided to accept our offer.
Oh, wow.
So we lived in the house for, I think, like 4 years. And then the pandemic hit and we were unable to keep it. But we pretty much restored the house and we're starting to operate it as a bed and breakfast. And we're doing like ghost tours there, groups to come in. They could stay in the house and do their investigations. And when it did go up for sale, I actually went into the Zillow listing and put in there like favorite thing about the house. And I wrote the ghost.
Yeah.
I wrote it right on the Zillow thing. So the people that bought it, that they saw right in the listing, it was haunted. So I didn't have to feel bad about it being haunted. And honestly, if it went up for sale and I had the money, I would buy it now.
Okay. So. This was a great final thought. Now, most states, you're not required to disclose it. However, there are 4 states, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, and Minnesota, you are required to disclose paranormal activity. And in 9 states, you're required to report any deaths. So mm-hmm. if someone died in the house, it varies how long you have to, how many years before you have to disclose it or whatever. So, yeah, that was interesting, I thought, final thought. Shout out. I got to do a shout out to Phil Shaw. Phil Shaw, he was a Vietnam vet. He was a minor league baseball coach. He even taught Sunday school. Phil was our go-to Bigfoot guy. Phil passed away July 10th. So my shout out goes to Phil, his family, and all the Bigfooters out there. You will be missed. Happy hunting, Phil. So you guys want to do a shout out for somebody, kids, or you also wrote with somebody, co-authored with someone, Rathsack?
Julie.
So
Julie, best friend. Absolutely.
Shout out to Julie.
To Julie.
All right.
Yeah, cool. She's actually writing the sequel to the Ghost of Grand Rapids book. Oh. She asked, because I was starting to get research together for a second book, and then she came up to me and she goes, is there any way, can I write it? I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to take this away from you. Absolutely.
Okay. Because
she helped with the Grand Rapids book. And so the sequel, I'm like, absolutely. So I kind of passed the torch to her, and she's currently writing it right now.
Mention your books again. Get all them titles in there.
All right. First one, Paranormal Lansing. Second one, Michigan's Haunted Nightlife. Haunted History of Kalamazoo. Ghost of Grand Rapids book. The fifth book was nothing to do with the paranormal. It just so happens to be a true crime case that I stumbled upon while doing research for the Kalamazoo book, and that was the 1955 abduction and murder of Jeannie Singleton, which at the time was listed as having the second largest manhunt ever in the state of Michigan. So that's number 5, and the name of that book is One Silent Voice, the Jeannie Singleton story.
Excellent. And then now your books are, of course, under Duchesne, but they might see your name as Bray.
Yes, yeah. So the earlier ones is going to say Nicole Bray instead of Nicole Duchesne.
Okay. And is that, I thought maybe there was one other book.
No? Is another book that she wrote quite a while ago, and then it got shelved and lost and erased, recovered, edited, and should go to print in the next few days.
As Twisted History of Kalamazoo.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so another non-paranormal, but completely interesting. I find like all the interesting things that happened in the old days of Kalamazoo, like Prohibition, you know, some of the things that was occurring in Kalamazoo and Prohibition, some of the prostitution that was taking place, just little odd crimes. There is an area of Kalamazoo that in the late 1800s was nicknamed the Murder Belt. So I went through all the cases from that area, stuff like that. So if anybody likes unusual history or even the dark side of history, that's what that book is about.
Former brothels keep showing up as being haunted.
Oh, yeah, like. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, upcoming, ongoing, your tours?
Tours. We still have the Grand Rapids and Kalamazoo tours. You can go to paranormalmichigan.com and find information on both of those. We are currently working on putting something together for South Haven. I've got a few cemeteries that we're putting together. Rob is just about ready to get his degree in app development. And so what we thought is putting together a Paranormal Michigan app. And it's going to have a list of cemeteries and cities throughout Michigan that you can go to the app, download it, and take your own self-guided ghost tours.
Wow, very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, Reverend Robert is also a demonologist.
Demonologist investigator.
So, yeah, that opens up whole new areas.
It does, yes.
Upcoming for us, I mean, and ongoing, is the 988 three-digit national suicide crisis hotline. I've been promoting that thing, getting that thing out there. So, especially if you're an American vet, you know, we lose a vet every 65 minutes. That's
incredibly sad.
Yeah. So, and there's other areas out there too with the kids that are struggling with their sexuality, who is also another group that's in crisis. But then ongoing for us, it's we're on TV, Comcast Channel 25 and UVerse 99. That's Mondays late and also Saturdays 12:30 late, around 12:30. Upcoming also for us, Grand Rapids Lectures. We're proud to announce Brandon and I are going to be lecturing not only all through October at all the KDLs, five different ones in October. We're going to go out to Wayland, where I went to high school. We're going back there. We were there once before, and that's the Heineke District Library there. And then we're going to the Flat River Community Library in Greenville in September.
Yeah, the Wayland one should be interesting because we had a little bit of activity before when we were out there. So it'll be interesting to see if we get anything this presentation. Because remember the last time we were at the Wayland one, we were doing the presentation. We had like we were doing the presentation. We had like a streak of light go, and like where the light went, like books fell off the shelf.
Yeah.
So that is something we did have the last time we presented there.
Now,
so
why can't that happen at our presentations? That would be so awesome.
Yeah.
We invite ghosts to ours.
Yeah.
That's what we've been doing wrong, Rob. Yeah. We need to invite them along.
So inspirational thought, and then it's over. I always tried to gear the inspirational thought to our guests. So this one comes from poet Susie Kasem, and it says this: stand for what is right, even if it means standing alone. Now, Brandon stood up alone for what he thought was right before. You guys, you're Mythbusters. You've been standing for what is right, getting the real message out there all through your books. I appreciate that extra effort you go through in your research. Great historians. Thanks so much for coming to this show.
Thank you, Nicole
and Reverend Robert Duchesne.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thanks so much. Peace out.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the producer and not necessarily those of WKTV Community Media.